The world in which we live, of course, wants to try to convince us, and this is the world in the Bible at least, that is opposed to the kingdom of Christ. It wants to assert itself as the only kingdom, and even does violence to the kingdom of God by sometimes killing its members, martyring them, getting rid of them, dispensing with them. And of course, the world never becomes a better place by killing the good people within it. But that's what the world will do, and that's what the world has done. We have our martyrs down through the centuries within the church, our persecutions of innocent people. The 20th century is full of kingdoms rising up under the leadership and dictatorship of some very self-centered people like Joseph Stalin. We know all this. It's all part of the history books. And they do a lot of harm to people, good people. One of my very good friends as I was growing up was my first cousin, Lisa. Now, she is a year younger than I was. When I, for example, was a senior in high school, she was a junior, and we went to the same high school. And as we grew, I grew in my vocation. I went through all my questions. I shared that with her, and as she grew, she went through her questions, and she shared them with me as I would come home from my studies at the seminary or what have you. And one of the questions that she had to deal with when she was going into that point at which she was dating men, that maybe this was it, you know. And she came up against this one fellow she was dating, and it became a question for her of, should I marry for lifestyle or should I follow my heart? That's really, it's an interesting question. Should I marry for lifestyle? Because this gentleman was a very kind gentleman, nothing wrong with him, but it wasn't there, it didn't click. And she couldn't really find anything wrong with him, but it just wasn't there. But she would have been very well cared for in a lifestyle upgrade. It would have been quite nice. Now, at the time, of course, from my perspective, all I could do was just listen a lot. And I do remember saying to her, though, how much better it would be to follow your heart. I didn't, you know, that's your call, but hey, this would be how I would see it. And she ended up not continuing that relationship, and she did eventually marry with a gentleman who was able to provide for her, but he never got that wealthy. He wasn't, and he still isn't. He's a good man. He worked with the Army Corps of Engineers doing mapping for the federal government, and you know, you don't get too wealthy doing that, but he was a good provider for the family and a good man. Well, what happened in my cousin's family, my uncle, of course, living in the same town, he was a doctor, he was very wealthy, and he did a lot of good for people. But every one of my cousins, well, they're all my cousins, of course, every other member of the family, they all became millionaires. I mean, two of them were doctors. One of them was in real estate, became a millionaire. Her younger sister, my cousin Lori, she married a fellow who was just a really good practical sense kind of guy. He founded a construction company and ushered it into millions of dollars of worth and became a millionaire. Hard work, real practical guy. One of those kind of guys, drives around in a pickup, a lot of common sense, and just a good man. But Lisa never came into that. And so as I came home, there was a subtle kind of put down that she went through in the family because she never did make it that big. They all had their cabins on the lake next to each other, and she didn't. They couldn't afford one. So when she went up there, she had to either stay with one of them or, you know, that kind of a thing. And she struggled with that a little bit. I feel so second rate in the family because we're not millionaires. And of course, what I kept trying to do from my perspective, which is coming from the gospel, is your value isn't determined by your social status. how much money you make, the car you drive. The world does attempt to convince us of this and that you're a better person if you're wealthy. It does try to convince you of that. And I am not in any way interested in setting up a Marxist critique of wealthy people, by the way. No way. That's not what I'm doing here. I'm not saying wealth is evil. But when we do, at least according to the Bible, turn that wealth and money into the source of our redemption, it's only a social redemption. It's no real redemption. Because money can't save you. It can't. You can't serve God and mammon. So the wealth itself isn't the problem. The bearers of it are. And of course, at least in my cousin's family, there was some pressure there from the worldly perspective on things to make it big. And my cousin didn't do that. You know, when you think about social status, Jesus came from a pretty rough part of town, you might say. Nazareth at the time was super poor, very poor. The poverty Jesus grew up in, as well as Mary, the mother of God, rivals the poorest section of the DFW Metroplex. They didn't have plumbing. They didn't have electricity. They didn't have air conditioning. They had none of these things. I'm certain Mary, for example, I mean, Joseph died eventually and she became a single mother raising a child. I'm sure she went to bed some nights hungry because she wanted to give the food to Jesus instead of herself. And she fed him and took care of him as he grew. And I'm certain she went to bed some nights hungry because they didn't have enough food. And you would say, well, Jesus is the Son of the living God. Why didn't he just fix it? Well, see, that's not how he works. He enters our lives as they are and then tries to help us get through them with the things that endure and not the passing things like what car you drive, what gated community you belong to, or whether you don't, or... And I mean, if you look at the tabernacle, that's the low-rent district of the DFW Metroplex, right there. Because he grew up in poverty. He's from the low social part of the ladder in the DFW Metroplex. Look at that. I mean, how non-threatening could you be as you look at that tabernacle? And as a result of the fact that he's somewhat low rent, a lot of people blow him off. Is he powerful? Oh yeah, he's very powerful. But he doesn't wield it in the way the world does. So we dismiss him. He can't give me what I want. What do you want? Depends what you want. Yeah. If what you want is a real racy car and a lot of money in the bank, and you're going to come to him to try to say, support me in that, that's not what he's about in your life. If what you're hoping for is a happy life of love, commitment, the values that last and endure into the kingdom, he's all on board for that. That's the first reading. Ask for anything you want, he said to Solomon. Whatever you want, ask for it. He could have asked for all the riches of the world. He could have asked for the most powerful army, all these kinds of things, and he didn't. What did he ask for? Wisdom to govern this people, to know right from wrong. Help me with this, Lord. And he was pleased with that. Well, what difference does it make? He's so irrelevant. He has nothing to... He can't help me at all. I'm suffering. Yeah. And that is our temptation, I think, because he doesn't wield his power like a worldly tyrant and get in there and start beating up people on my behalf, because that's not how he is. He doesn't have a gulag where he sends incorrigible people that don't cooperate. He doesn't operate that way. And so we dismiss him. And what the gospel is saying today, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure buried in a field, and a person discovers that treasure and they sell everything and go for it. And what we have today is people are walking away from the treasure. And there it is, hidden in the obscurity of such insignificance and poverty and humility that we deem it irrelevant. And people are walking away in droves because they're after the worldly stuff. They want to advance and become powerful. They want to be what the world has to give them, the visible stuff. It's only worth something if it's visible, if I see it, and it's tangible, and it's got a lot of zeros after my bank book. That's all that matters. And it's all the stuff he's trying to say is not important. Yeah, we have to feed our families, yes. But it's never going to be enough if you're going to go down that path. It never will, because there will always be someone else who has more. Always. And so what the gospel today is attempting to try to get us to realize is there are riches in the kingdom that are worth sacrificing for and dedicating your life to. You don't drift into love. You don't drift into it. He proved that going up Calvary. You don't drift into that kind of love. You go into that on purpose, and you go in there and you start working at it. And that's what he helps us do, is work at it. Love isn't easy. The culture of the world will tell you it does. It makes you feel better and always feels good. And then when the feeling's gone, so are you. Hit the highway. That's not love. I think Good Friday was a bad day in his love relationship with us. We gave him every reason to finally just say, you know what, I am done with you people. And he didn't. You don't drift into that kind of love. You don't casually go into that kind of love. No, you find that treasure, and guess what? You sell everything and buy that field because it's worth it. Because there are certain riches, treasures, and goods in this life that can't be seen. But boy, they matter, because we're not only a body, we're also a soul. And the soul has its hungers, its thirsts. And honestly, Madison Avenue would love to have God out of the picture so that it can tell you, hey, I've got the created good that's going to satisfy that hunger in your soul. And they're just going to cha-ching, 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 and make all kinds of money off of that longing that's in your soul that, guess what, only God can satisfy. So they don't want God in this picture. The world doesn't want God around at all. It's making too much money out of our denial of him. That's the world. That's how the world operates. It's always operated that way. We find it in the Bible. And it's happening today too. It shouldn't surprise us. But what Jesus is trying to tell us is there are other values, other riches worth sacrificing for that can even sustain and be sustained through bodily suffering and difficulty, as the soul becomes satisfied by the treasure that you've discovered and want to stay with. When my father died, I've discovered this since I've been in this life for over 40 years, and I did discover at a certain point how I was brought up with some of these worldly values to achieve and all this sort of a thing, which is not a bad thing. I'm not saying it is. I put a tremendous amount of effort into my life to achieve and make something of myself. But a lot of that striving was worldly. And my dad was kind of saddled with that until the end of his life when he started to die from cancer. And he felt bad. He didn't have a whole lot of wealth to leave my mother. And he felt really bad about that. My mother was going to be okay, but he wanted to do more for her. He wanted to do more for all of us, but he wasn't able to. And I remember sitting with him before he died, and I said to him, "You know, Dad, do you realize all your children are still practicing the faith? Do you realize that your children are all in marriages that are happy? Do you realize you have a son that is a priest?" I said, you've got wealth here that a lot of people would be very happy to have. And I just was saying that to say, you know, there's more than just monetary, financial wealth in this world. There's a lot of other things that are quite valuable, like children that are happy. Not because you can buy them the most exalted thing or the best car or whatever. There's a lot more to be happy about than that. And that's what we're talking about today. And there's your treasure. And yes, he is hidden in obscurity and humility. The world really is not that impressed with humility, but dismissive. And it really doesn't matter. Are you wealthy? Are you poor? Are you middle class? It doesn't matter. You're talking to someone who grew up in the low rent district of Nazareth. Even Nathan said, "Can anything good come from Nazareth? It's such a low life town. You got to be kidding me. You're going to introduce me to a Messiah and he comes from Nazareth? There's no way." He wasn't impressed at all. But Nathan found the treasure hidden in the field. And there he is, brothers and sisters, right there in that tabernacle. Is he powerful? Oh, yes, he is. And you know what? I'm going to end with this. A bit of a challenge in the faith, because last weekend we heard about it. Jesus lamented that many are seeing, but they don't see. They're hearing, but they're not hearing. Well, guess what? Most of us in this chapel have been able to see just how powerful he is in this seemingly disarming, quiet, somewhat irrelevant, real presence of the tabernacle that we dismiss so readily. Oh, yes, if you have eyes to see it, you can see it. And if you have ears to hear it, it's there. The signal's going out because the kingdom of God is in our midst. It is. Do you realize the Soviet Union completely collapsed without a shot fired? Do you realize that? Politicians don't do that. They're all lining up to take credit for it. Politicians, all they do is escalate the worldly power. We're going to have bigger bombs. We're going to have bigger bombs. We're going to put bigger bombs into space, and we're going to escalate. That's what they do. And then we have a big fight, you know, World War I, World War II, and we beat each other up and kill and maim until finally one side wins. That's what politicians do. The Soviet Union collapsed and not a single shot was fired. Now that is power. And Our Lady did that. Our Lady did. This poor, humble woman from Nazareth, she did that. Because they shot her son on his front doorstep. It was surgical. The system that hired the third-party gun to go in and do that deed, it's gone. It doesn't exist on the face of the earth. The Lord takes care of His own. In fact, in the second reading, we're told He makes all things in this world work together, not for everybody, but for the good of those who love Him. Oh, yes. We're not talking necessarily an egalitarianism here. He favors those who love Him. And He knows how to bring you into His kingdom, which will last not as long as the Roman government. Where's that today? Not as long as the Soviet Union. Where's that today? This kingdom lasts forever.